support comes from ARC Industries, providing business solutions to Columbus's industrial, retail, and commercial markets, and helping people with disabilities find meaningful work. ARC Industries, dedicated to the success of its customers, employees, and community. ARC Industries is online at arcind.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's time for our weekly reporter roundtable with a panel of State House reporters this week. Joining us, Mark Kovac. He's a State House reporter for the Youngstown Vindicator. Welcome back, Mark.
Good morning.
And also Joe Ingles, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Good morning.
And Julie Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Julie, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right. What else? Let's just wrap this baby up. Although the Ed Fitzgerald story is not over, the Eric Kearney story is over with. He is, of course, was the running mate for Ed Fitzgerald for the Democratic governor ticket, the Democratic ticket for governor. So
right, he Eric Kearney, state senator. Thought to be sort of a nice bump for the Fitzgerald campaign, which is not, they have a name recognition problem outside of Cleveland, and brought in a Cincinnati lawyer who also is well-respected for his fundraising. And, you know, his problem was that he has a lagging business down in Cincinnati, a newspaper business of all things, and had nearly $1 million. We were saying on the wire about 700,000 that were really that I personally could document in tax liens, and it was just a huge problem for them. It was a huge problem for them internally in terms of communications.
Is it a bigger problem that the press largely had to kind of drag it out of them, Joe?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is when you have someone who's relatively unknown and the first thing out of the gate is they put someone in as their running mate that has these huge tax liens, it leads to the question of why. And people ask questions about why was this person picked? Did they know? You know, and, you know, of course, he says, yes, they Eric.
And you're damned if you do
know.
And you're damned if you don't. I mean, yeah. If you do know, it's like, why'd you put him in?
Yeah.
If you didn't know.
Yeah, it raises a lot of questions, and it should be said that Eric Kearney himself tried to answer some of these questions with a teleconference a few days before he stepped down, but the teleconference obviously was not in person. Ed Fitzgerald was not on the line at that teleconference. Eric Kearney kept referring to some sort of Excel form or something like that that had tabs on it with amounts of, you know, things that were owed. But the reporters didn't have that when the teleconference started, and it was just completely confusing. And that's not the thing you want when you're trying to clear the air. You don't want to raise more questions.
Yeah, he was announced one week on a Wednesday, and then the next Wednesday he was on that that conference call, which, I mean, was kind of like a train wreck.
Well, it was that fast now.
Yeah,
I guess I was following it the following Tuesday
that he stepped out of the race, you know, so it all happened within like a 3 week period. It was very quick.
Right. Well, and one of the issues was that I'm sure the communications team thought this stuff was well known. It was public documents. It was the reporters were finding this in databases that were online, tax filings, court records.
The usual scrutiny a candidate would get.
And it had been in the press, in some of it, in Cincinnati when he had run in the past. So I think they thought it was old news. It was done. Huh. The problem is once you rise to that state level stage, mm-hmm. and it hasn't been heard in Cleveland, and it hasn't been heard in Toledo and Youngstown and Columbus, you have to be ready to answer those questions.
And the debt hasn't been paid.
Right, correct.
I remember the U.S. Senate race, Mike DeWine running against John Glenn. Now, John Glenn won that, his final term in office. He won that race. But Mike DeWine kept pummeling him for a debt he owed to various vendors from his presidential campaign.
Right. Yeah, I mean, debts are a problem, and especially when your party is running on a platform of tax responsibility and wanting to use the taxes that we all pay for the very programs that they are advocating.
Go ahead, Mark.
He took the position that, look, I'm a businessman, and I could have shut this all down and laid the people off, and I didn't. This is just normal struggles of a business during a recession. You know, and he's like, I tried to do the right thing. We've made arrangements to make the payments, and there just were so many questions about, okay, what did the campaign know? When did it know the stuff that it was supposed to know? And it just fumbled the answers so often that, you know, it just couldn't stay in the race.
We are listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, the last of the year. If you have a question or comment, have an issue that you want to ask about, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So Eric Kearney, still, the last dredges I read about him is how well-respected he is as a lawmaker. He's still on both sides of the aisle.
Well, it was very interesting to watch the responses. It gave you the impression, because it was coming from the Black Caucus leaders, the mayor of Columbus, Michael Coleman, said something very nice about him. And I think that that showed a couple things. One is you knew who had pushed him onto the ticket. Hmm. Number two, you knew who might want to be the running mate if it's not Eric. So we're looking to see, and Fitzgerald told me in an interview last week that it's not necessarily going to be based on race. It wasn't based on race the first time. It certainly gave some diversity to the ticket because Kearney is African-American, but it might not necessarily have to be that, but he needs something. He needs a bump of some kind still. He can't sort of pick a lackluster running mate.
Right.
Yeah, and right now, I mean, there are a lot of questions out there being raised. Newspapers and just general people are raising questions about Jobs Ohio, and it's still at that very low level. You know, we don't know a whole lot. There's a lot of questions. And it's the time that you would expect the other side to kind of come in and, you know, kind of push that maybe a little bit, push those political buttons. But the Democrats have really lost traction with this whole Kearney thing. They've spent so much time on that that they haven't been able to really focus on jobs. I mean, they've sent out press releases and that sort of thing, but to actually get in there and focus like they normally would, they haven't had that opportunity because they've been dealing with all this other stuff with Eric Kearney.
I thought it was interesting, the Republican Party response, you know, isn't it terrible what Ed Fitzgerald did to Eric Kearney, you know, dragging this poor businessman through the mud, you know, for three weeks.
I didn't see that.
Funny response, you know.
Yeah, since Eric Kearney's gone now, we still have to stay focused on, which you got to give him credit for staying focused on the project at hand. So, all right, so who are some of the possibilities out there? Any idea? I mean, Eric Kearney kind of came out of nowhere for a lot of people.
Right.
People weren't expecting that.
Zach Klein here in Columbus, he's a city councilman.
Right.
Which would be, in my opinion, sort of safe. Let's not make any waves or whatever. And then another is maybe Tracy Maxwell Hurd, who's the Democratic leader in the House right now. It's been impressive to some people.
Another Central Ohioan.
Right.
I agree. I've heard both of those names, especially Tracy Maxwell Hurd, mentioned in some of these situations. Also, down in Cincinnati, if you wanted to stay down there, there's Mark Mallory.
Uh-huh.
Well-respected. He has a sense of humor.
Two-term city mayor of Cincinnati.
He's been in state politics.
State lawmaker when I was covering it. Yeah.
Right. And he has a lot of experience to bring to the job. But the thing that he has that anyone who's met Mark Mallory, he has that typical, I don't know how to explain it, the charisma of the thing that goes with it, where you can be on your feet and cut a joke and kind of make fun of yourself. And so there's a certain quality about him that would, a personal quality that could go well with Ed Fitzgerald, who's relatively unknown.
And he comes from a family dynasty,
right,
they've called it, of politicians.
Yes, right.
His father just passed away last week.
And he had been a House majority leader for 28 years.
Right.
So, and his brother's on the bench. His other brother is in the legislature. So, you know, that would be a nice mix, too, for the ticket.
Occasionally you hear Charlita Tavares' name pop up, too, in that. But I don't think we'll know until January, right?
Do you think he'll wait until after the holidays?
That's what he told me. I think that they want to go back on. That would be the more typical timeline anyway. So I think they're hoping that everyone just forgets about this and they start over. I don't know. I mean, we had the situation before where Jim Pietro switched running mates in the middle of a race. But, of course, Jim Pietro didn't win the governor's race
switched
either.
From who to who? Refresh my
from
memory.
From Phil Heimlich to Joy Padgett.
Yes.
And then Joy Padgett was the one with the debts. So
that's right.
And, you know, if speaking about, you know, the lieutenant governor, really, I mean, they do a lot internally, but as far as, you know, outwardly, it's not a position where the tax liens and that sort of thing would be involved in the daily kind of work that they do. It's more of a position of, Mary Taylor, our current lieutenant governor.
She's at a lot of chambers of commerce meetings all I ever see her going to.
Right. She does that. She's, you know, charged with trying to help bring business into Ohio. She's, you know, she kind of oversees that area, but she's not out there, physically laying the hammer down to collect taxes. I mean, that kind of thing. So it's not, it's the kind of job that this kind of thing can really hurt you. But it's not exactly what you're going to do. So, you know, you can debate it that way as well.
I'm trying to think of all the different... Being a lieutenant governor, it's what you make of it.
Mike DeWine was a lieutenant governor.
He surely was. Yeah. And considered one of the best overall. Mary Taylor gets into the insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Director of the Department of Insurance.
Right. Department of Insurance, but she's always at Chamber of Commerce meetings.
Lee Fisher was head of the Department of Development.
Department of Development, right.
And typically that's what they do is development. They do, you know, fostering business, trying to bring business in.
Isn't that Jobs Ohio?
Well, it was.
Okay.
It sort of still is. I mean, you know, the Department of Development is kind of rolled into, you know, the whole Jobs Ohio thing. But when Jobs Ohio took over, they took a lot of those responsibilities with them. But the state still has a component to that as well.
But Bob Taft had Maureen O'Connor, who was on crime, public safety director. Now she's the chief justice.
So
it can take you a lot of directions.
Yeah.
Well, what about Jobs Ohio? How's it doing? Is there any end of the year tally on jobs created?
Well, the last report that came out, you know, the numbers were lagging. I wasn't at the meeting that they had, but didn't they say they're going to start announcing their results monthly now to try to give the public a little better idea of what's going on? I think at least the perception out there is that they're not delivering the kind of jobs numbers that were promised during the campaign if we made the change. So that's because of those headwinds from Washington, I assume.
Right. They had a nice bump there for a while, first couple of years, but they have not, they've kind of slowed down.
But people question whether that bump came from work that took place before Jobs Ohio was created. These things, as everyone is telling us all the time, they take time.
Yeah, they do. And if you look at Jobs Ohio, there have been some missteps. Even they would say that there have been some things that they would have probably done different in hindsight. You know, some of the things that they spent money on initially, setting up the office, that kind of got out there and kind of created waves. And there are a lot of things that Jobs Ohio they're doing or not doing, and we don't have access to them because of all of the laws and that have been passed that say, hey, media, public, you can't see this. You can't see this document. You can't know this. And it's those kind of things that really raise questions because, of course, you tell the media we can't have something, and that makes us all the more curious by nature.
Well, and I think one of the things that's going to perhaps haunt the Kasich campaign is what Mark Kwame took.
Former head of Jobs Ohio, the first head.
And took away from that position. I mean, he sort of parlayed it into this pitch he's making around the state for Drive Capital and a big new innovation fund. Mm-hmm. They're saying, we're going to make the Midwest the new Silicon Valley.
They
we think we can do that.
Got $50 million out of Ohio State University.
Right.
Right.
And they pitched at least to Oprah's, the public pension fund.
Ohio Public Employee Retirement System.
Right. Mm-hmm. So
but they didn't
it's just
buy
very, it's going to be interesting to see sort of where that goes and whether
And he
that...
recently made the news as well. People are questioning how much he's getting out of that personally.
Right.
The deal from Ohio State, maybe $7 million personally.
Right. It looks like $7 to $9 million. The other thing that's going on in terms of how this might play out for the campaign is that the Supreme Court decision has not been made on the constitutionality
of the closed records.
Right.
Right. We are going to take a break. We'll return to our conversation with Julie Carr Smythe of the AP, Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator when we return. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We have a reporter's roundtable. It's the last one before the end of the year, so if you have any questions about what's going on in state government and politics, maybe one of my guests can help you find the answer. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, I might have muddied the waters a little bit when we were talking about Jobs Ohio and the issues before the Ohio Supreme Court. Mark, there's the open records issue.
Well,
I
think the records issue has already been decided.
That was the one.
But I think she filed for reconsideration.
And she was unrelated to, at the time, the other lawsuit, and they've said it's okay if it's closed records. That's
correct.
What they told her. So now before them is another question of standing.
Yeah. Whether or not it's Progress Ohio is the lead on that, right? That whether or not they have the standing to actually challenge the constitutionality of Jobs Ohio and the liquor profits and how it's funded. And I'm if I were a betting man, I would bet we'd see that decision before the end of the year. I could be wrong on that, but it seems like a good Christmas Eve decision to come out or something.
Yeah. Some obscure time, I would bet.
And it's an interesting case because there's another group, the anti-gambling group Ohio Roundtable, that is trying to get standing on another move by Kasich. And so we've got 1851 Center arguing this case. The Jobs Ohio case, which is a libertarian group.
With a conservative libertarian group.
Right. And then we've got Roundtable as an interested party in that as
well. Another conservative organization.
And so, I mean, a lot of the advocacy groups are saying, we don't care what your party is. People should have the ability to question the constitutionality of actions of a governor. So it's going to be fascinating to see what the decision ultimately is.
Right. And if they say it is constitutional, what the basis for that is and how they explain that.
Right. Or even getting to the point.
But otherwise, don't hold your breath.
If they give them standing, I assume we're going to see another drawn out legal process to work through the constitutionality issues. So I don't think we're going to see resolution to that if they give standing anytime soon. Now, if they don't give standing, what's the counter argument that a business that didn't get a grant is the entity? I think it would be someone who could sue Jobs
Ohio.
Could
anybody? Yes.
But just an average citizen who doesn't like the fact that the state is leasing its liquor profits to a private nonprofit with no transparency and no public access to the records. Can't go in and say, hey, I want to challenge that and overturn
it. Well, a private nonprofit whose employees benefit from public employee retirement system, right? I mean, aren't they public employees?
I'm not sure about that.
Oh, I don't think so, are
okay.
they?
Okay.
I wasn't sure.
I'm not positive either.
Yeah,
well,
how
would we know?
That's a good question. I wonder if we can get access to those records to find out.
Okay. Bill in Dublin, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Yes, good morning. Whatever happened to the court case, the Ohio Supreme Court, on the Medicaid expansion? And I'll take your answer off the air, if that's okay.
Okay, Bill, thank you.
Thank you.
They haven't ruled on that yet.
That's
have they?
Any day now, right?
Now, tell us about that case.
Well, It's basically there's a case that's been filed by some conservatives saying that the state did not have the authority to enter into, or that the government,
the controlling board,
and the governor.
There we go. Who did this through the controlling board, yeah, versus the legislature?
Right. That the way that it was handled, that they did not have the authority to do that. That it had to go through the legislature, and they sent that to the court, and we're still waiting to see what the court decides on that.
So it's pending.
They said it was the lawmakers' intent that Medicaid eligibility was not expanded without full votes of both chambers.
Right.
And they put that in the budget. I believe the governor used his line item veto power to strike some of that language. So the question is, what's lawmaker intent? Is it what's in state law, or is it what lawmakers sent to the governor?
Mm.
And so we had, you know, weeks of lots of filings in that case from interested parties. And I would assume, again, any day now we should see something on that.
It makes me think of all different kinds of laws I've looked at over the years and thought, what were they thinking?
And oh, there have been a lot of those.
And when you hear them arguing at this level about lawmaker intent, it makes you realize, you know, it's really hard to find out years later.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't even find out a few months later, definitively what is lawmaker intent. All right, so the expansion goes forward at this point. The Medicaid expansion per the order of the governor.
Online enrollments are happening as we speak, I assume.
And I understand that the online enrollments for that are going well as it's starting to smooth out the healthcare.gov in Ohio is starting to smooth out, and people are getting signed up in a prompt way now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
people would probably argue with that.
Yeah, well, there's always going to be someone.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
it's easier
inevitable.
Than it was
it's
2 months
than
ago.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
Okay. So the controlling board, before we move on, is voting on the first round of straight aid grants. The controlling board, by the way, is a body of lawmakers.
Mm-hmm.
The party that leads the legislature controls the legislature, controls the controlling board. And if the governor happens to be of the same party, then all the better. There are a few Democrats on.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think the director of it, or the chairman, is an appointee
it's
of the
president,
governor.
Okay.
Or the
yeah.
president. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he can break ties, isn't it? Or yeah. But they are a body that can be sleepy for years and years and then do something really.
They approve spending mm-hmm. of over, was it 50,000 and over? Or
right. So you write a state budget, you allot certain amounts for things, but then as the 2 years pass, different things come up that are unbid contracts of a certain amount that need to have clearance. And so some of these, they have a consent agenda, they call it, that just races through every month where they have to approve of hundreds of things, but then some will be pulled back and be heavily debated, like the Medicaid expansion. I mean, we've put, I believe, No Child Left Behind federal funding through that committee.
Mm-hmm.
Video lottery money comes through there, and it gets really interesting when it's something that people want to look to block or debate. So these straight aid grants are the first round from the $250 million fund that Kasich created in the last budget. They're innovation grants, so they're supposed to be interesting ways to improve efficiency in schools. And I took a look through the list, and there are $88 million. And the list mostly is in line with his own agenda, I would say. I mean, a bunch of the money, about a quarter of the money, is going for things that are going to enhance Marcellus and Utica Shale education somehow, either, you know, in Carrollton schools, they're going to create maybe a pathway for energy jobs and that kind of thing. So that was interesting. And then a lot of them are more money in the classroom and trying to eliminate administrative costs, that kind of thing. There's an e-school initiative, enhancement of, campus sharing between high schools and universities. And there's going to be a new early college high school in Marysville. So a lot of it relates to, I'd say, a Republican education agenda. And that's been one of the criticisms of these is sort of, well, you could have just taken $250 million and spread it across the state. All the school districts are
hard up.
In need. Yeah. And so this is sort of a little slush fund for the governor for his pet projects.
And they're voting on the first round of straight A grants. Is that today?
It is. And they've already announced the recipients. This is just kind of a rubber stamp.
Okay.
So
you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Speaking of education, one-third of Ohio's third graders scored too far below a new literacy target for reading. They're going to have to retake the third grade, right?
Not yet.
Okay.
This is sort of the red flag for their parents, and I'm sure all across the state, parents of third graders are freaking out because they probably heard from their superintendent or their principal about that. It's not unexpected that at the beginning of third grade, you aren't proficient in what you need to know at the end of third grade. I mean, it's sort of... Mm-hmm. Should I call it a no-brainer? But, you know, they're... In some districts, these are hugely high numbers. And so it just put a lot of parents around the state on alert that, hey, if your child doesn't improve in reading, there's a possibility that you could be held back.
Okay, so the test would be for that in the spring?
Yes.
Okay.
And there's supposed to be some intervention between now and the spring so that you can get reading tutors in there and help those kids who have failed in the fall. The idea is to bring them all up and make sure they do pass it.
And not only fail, but some kids failed worse than others.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If they failed in the spring, then they still have a shot at it during the summer to get some more intervention, go to summer school or whatever, and try to bring those scores up. And the way the law is written, as I understand it, is some of those kids, even though they're failing third grade reading, they may be at their grade level in math or science. And so they could be allowed in the next year to take those fourth grade classes and those subjects while they're getting, you know, extra help in the third grade class.
But this all starts to get confusing.
It does. Mm-hmm.
This all sounds like you're getting pulled out for a reading class now. You're not really getting held back.
Right, because and it is interesting, is they even said in the teleconference on this last week that the kids could mid-year move from third grade into fourth grade. So it could just be intensive reading help at the start of the year and then moving in. And I think that's a little bit, just remembering my daughter's experience, I mean, that can be very unsettling to a kid to be started in one class and move to another class. Mm-hmm. So I think that probably... will be interesting to watch the pushback this month.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, we've got to remember where this idea came from. This idea came from for years and years, we had students who were graduating high school and they weren't proficient in basic skills. And the question was raised, well, how did they graduate high school? How do you graduate middle school or elementary school without knowing these things? So this is part of the pushback so that the politicians and the school leaders and the powers that be can say, hey, look, we did something. We're holding them accountable.
Well, there's a lot of truth. It's clear that there is a breakdown. If you cannot read by the third grade, mm-hmm. after that, the focus goes to content, not reading skills, but what you're reading, not how to read. And that's where you start to fall behind.
Yeah, and the guarantee includes, I believe the way it's set up is they start in kindergarten trying to assess these kids and where they are at in reading. So the goal is to give them help leading up to the third grade. So that's not just, okay, third grade, suddenly I can't read. Now we've got to intervene and do something. Mm-hmm. They're trying to intervene sooner to help these kids and bring them up to proficiency as they go.
It was something that was put forth by Governor Kasich in the beginning of his first term, right? The third grade reading guarantee, mm-hmm. I think, is when he first put it out there. Who's paying for it? Has that ever been resolved? Because as we all know, special reading instructions, extremely expensive.
Well, I do know they had to revisit the bill maybe even a couple of times because of the fact that districts were saying, wait a minute, we don't have the resources to do this the way you've written the law. We don't even have the people that, I mean, the description of who had to do this didn't include enough people to do it. Mm-hmm. And so, especially with you look at these numbers, some districts had, 75% of the kids were below the mark. That's a lot of intervention. So it's a good question, and I now can't remember the answer to it. I think it's just part of your district funding.
You just got to buck up.
Yeah, but I think there are a lot of, Innovation Ohio has looked at this issue, and there are a lot of Democratic groups that have looked at this issue and say that this is the problem, that it's woefully, it doesn't have the funding it needs, and that the people aren't there to do this job, and that it's punitive. And basically, they want to see more funding in this area, and this comes up every time there's a pot of money that could be used for tax relief. They're saying, hey, let's, put more funding in the third grade guarantee and get those students up to where they need to be, and then we can worry about, giving another tax break. So it seems to be part of that pitch to try to bring in more money for this program.
We're going to take another break, then we'll continue our conversation with Mark Kovac of the Youngstown Vindicator, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable from the State House. If you have a question about state government or politics, you can join the conversation. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to get some predictions from our three reporters here, Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Mark Kovac from the Youngstown Vindicator, and Julie Carr-Smythe from the Associated Press. About what's going to be coming up in 2014. And we were just talking about the fact that apparently the Ohio House was unable to get a resolution through denoting or making the some kind of proclamation of making it November Pancreatic Cancer Awareness Month. They weren't able to get that done in the right month. So I don't know. Maybe that's something they're going to wait a year to do and do it next year. In any event, there is legislation in the Ohio House passed earlier last week on animal abuse, and it is interesting. Joe Ingles, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, basically, for a long time now, we've heard animal rights activists and animal lovers say that Ohio is woefully behind when it comes to animal abuse. We've all read those stories and seen those stories where cats and dogs have been just brutally killed, and the person goes away with a smack on the wrist and, it's not a big deal, a little community service. And, a lot of people are pointing to studies that show, there are a lot of studies out there, frankly, that show that people who are abusive to dogs and cats go on to be abusive to other people. You might remember Jeffrey Dahmer, the serial killer. He started out with pets, companion pets, and then went on to be abusive to other people. So this bill basically would take it from a misdemeanor to a low-level felony. And that means that you could get some jail time. You could get up to 1 year in jail for abusing a dog or a cat. But the other thing is that the court can mandate that you get intervention. And that's important because if you've got a troubled person who is starting to go down this route of abusing a dog or a cat, and they would be the type of person who would commit this kind of crime on another human being, the thought process is that if you can get them into some sort of intervention, it would help. So this gives a lot more, by increasing the penalty, it gives the judge a lot more opportunity to go in there and treat it in a more serious way. And you've got to also mention that this is more in line with other states. Other states have, a lot of other states already have felony level convictions for companion dog and cat abuse. This does not pertain to livestock on a farm. This does not cover working animals that, might have a job that someone might say, hey, that's a little abusive. It doesn't cover that. This covers Fluffy, it covers Fido, it covers your animals that are in the house, you know, that are pets. That's the dogs and cats that are covered. It's passed the House, and now it will go on to the Senate and see what the senators say about it.
Neither House is in session again for the rest of the year. Some poor members of a committee. What committee is that, Mark?
The House Health Committee is meeting tomorrow.
All right, go House Health Committee. They're still in town. It's possible, though, a few of them have a fundraiser or some such thing. It happens.
That's probably true.
They're not going to be in town. Nothing really is going to happen, supposedly, before the beginning of next year. When do they return?
Next year.
Like, how soon?
Is there a schedule out for right voting sessions next year?
I don't
year?
Know if there is. Usually it's around January 6th yeah. or so. Yeah.
Typically it's around the beginning of that second week of January.
And I wanted to get some predictions from you. What do you think is going to happen next week? I mean, next year.
Oh, next year. Well, I think it's going to be purely political. I mean, we're already seeing the signs of politics and everything, anything that's done at the state anymore is scrutinized on a political level by pundits. And, oh, boy, 2014 is looking like it could be the most nasty political year yet if you look at the signs that we're getting already in 2013.
I feel like we may yet see a big shakeup on the Democratic ticket because they have not yet actually nominated their slate. We know that they have in place Ed Fitzgerald for governor, David Pepper for attorney general, let's see, Connie Pillich for Secretary of State.
Treasurer, I'm sorry.
Secretary of State is Nina Turner.
Okay.
And who's against Yoast?
State Representative from Columbus.
Carney.
Right, Carney. I'm yeah, sorry, okay. John Patrick Carney. Sorry, John Patrick Carney, if you're listening. We
it's
remember.
Early.
But anyway, there was a lot of talk after the Carney shuffle that maybe some of these would be moved around. We also have always looming out there the Jennifer Bruners and the Richard Cordrays of the world, who are much better known than Fitzgerald. And I know not what their plans are, but certainly what their supporters who hang around the State House a lot would love to see one of them sweep in and sort of fix the mess of last week that happened with the Fitzgerald campaign. Maybe it's unlikely, but it's, you know, it's something for us to think about in the media what might happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, from a legislative standpoint, I think we're looking at another mid-biennium budget review bill coming, you know, which could keep us swamped with all kinds of interesting policies for the next 6 months. You know, I would assume that could include another tax cut of some kind.
The first mid-biennium legislative budget review,
the MBR,
was because there was so little policy in the first budget.
Well,
was because John Kasich used to be on Capitol Hill and he liked the one-year cycle. He laid his budget out like a congressional budget where he would have a budget note for each change. And I just think that he was accustomed to that one-year cycle. And they did a lot of significant stuff in the second
MBR. And much to the annoyance of some lawmakers who thought they would have a little lighter schedule in the year after a budget bill.
Mm-hmm.
But they were just as busy with that, with, you know, that's when her severance tax was in that, or, you know, before it was taken out. There's all kinds of stuff in that. And right. So who knows what they'll put in the next one and how lengthy it'll be.
And just so listeners understand that, I mean, when you're making sweeping policy decisions and spending money, I mean, that's the biggest deal of what the legislature does. So you typically, prior to Kasich, would have this two-year cycle where you'd pass the budget in 1 year, and then the second year, maybe they'd dig into some different issues that were non-spending related. And this has just been a rigorous, continuous, annual budget cycle.
And it's going to provide fuel for that fire that I said we're going to see, that political fire that we're going to see.
Uh-huh.
And believe me, if they're down there debating a budget and debating a lot of heavy policy, oh, it's going to come out of the woodwork every day.
On the lighter prediction side, it's time to start speculating where the governor is going to have his State of the State speech next year. He took it on the road to Steubenville.
Well, what are they? Is it like the Christmas tree? Do they all have to make bids or something? Does somebody else? Because he has it at different.
It was Steubenville last year. It was Lima this year. Yeah. I'm putting my money on someplace like Portsmouth this year.
Portsmouth.
Okay. All right.
Willard. Talked about prescription drug abuse.
About Willard. Yeah.
Willard.
It's got to be sort of outside of the big.
I'll pick Alliance.
Alliance. Okay. All right. What about something up in that far west corner? Maybe Van Wert?
Oh, yeah, that'd be way out.
That's too close to Lima.
That takes a long time.
They've already covered.
You're right. That's right. That's too close to Lima.
And I'm going to predict it will be the worst weather that we'll have to drive through to get there, too.
Oh, it was a big hassle last year.
Yeah. It was like, you've seen like the Wild West where there's all the big dust balls. Well, we had that with snow, so you couldn't see to drive to Lima, and you're just like swerving around on the road trying to keep in the center of the lines. And boy, it was icy and snowy and nasty.
Elizabeth in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I was calling with a comment about the third grade guarantee.
Yeah.
So shortly after my daughter, who's now in fourth grade, started kindergarten, I got a letter sent home saying that she was in danger of not passing third grade, which is a little bit concerning.
You mean the reading thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
But they just worded it the way it was worded was really like, your daughter, is in danger of not passing third grade.
And she was in kindergarten.
And she was actually tested on her very first day of kindergarten. And I don't think she maybe even knew what a test was, if she was fooling around or thinking it was funny. I have no idea. But I do know, I think in theory it sounds like a good idea, but in execution, I'm not sure it's happened, so well. I think that was the first year, her class was the first year that they did it.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think it's hurt her confidence a little bit.
Well, I was going to ask you, did you tell her about this?
Well, yeah, the teacher did, and now she basically was like red flagged and put on the top of the list. I actually saw the list. It had like little red flags, orange flags, yellow flags, and green flags on the kids' names based on this test of their danger of not passing third grade. And so when I had the first student conference, parent-teacher conference, I saw the list, and apparently she knew that she was red flagged, and it's interesting because I do think it's hurt her confidence.
Interesting.
I wonder how much of that is a local decision on how they handle that. I mean, that doesn't seem like off the cuff a great way to handle it.
You're Granville schools, right?
No, it wasn't in Granville schools.
Was it Newark?
No.
Okay.
No.
You know what this sounds like? When I was in school back in the Stone Ages, they used to have different levels, level one, level two, level
three. I was always
three.
The bluebirds.
Yeah. And some of them they had, the animals or whatever, but then there were colors or
the color-coded book sets, remember those?
Yeah, and you knew that if you were in a certain class that you were smarter than the kids in these other classes.
Right.
And
right.
It sounds like, that's what it reminds me of when you're talking about it, Elizabeth.
Yeah, I didn't even think kids that kindergartners were, aware of that, but she definitely was aware that, she had some kind of problem and needed to be taken out to special literacy classes, and all of which are very good. It was more the way it was handled.
Yeah.
This seems very strange because I guess since it was a state law, they have an obligation to notify you. They have an obligation that as a parent, they have to sit down and tell you and make a plan for your child so that they can pass third grade. And the whole time I was saying, you tested her first day of kindergarten, I don't even know how accurate that is, but it doesn't matter. It's the state test, so that's what they do.
Well, and I do think that some districts, as Mark says, since this is somewhat, it is being executed at the local level, some districts have written letters to parents that basically say, don't blame us. This is the state that has done this. And, I don't know if they're going so far as to try to get parents to lobby the state lawmakers to change it. But I do anticipate when we talk about next year that now that this is hitting, as you're describing so well, it hits a family and a kid very directly that some of the lawmakers will start to hear about those impacts.
Hmm. All right, Elizabeth, thanks a lot for that call. It is interesting. It'd be interesting to hear about how different districts are handling it and what their lexicon is. It is odd to think of a kindergartner being told they won't pass the third grade. Of course they won't. They're in kindergarten. You know. Email from Cody asks, what is the likelihood of marriage equality passing on the ballot next fall? Would it be better if they waited until 2016? There's two schools of thought on that. Julie?
Boy, a prognosis here. I think the movement is in that direction. There certainly are some powerful folks trying to work on that campaign, including Jim Petro, mm-hmm. Who is a Republican, moderate Republican, well-known around the state. So I think that gives it a boost, and there's bipartisan support for it. That being said, there will certainly be a lot of money spent against it in a state like Ohio that's so purple. So I'm not quite prepared to make my prediction yet.
Well, the other thing to remember that if it were to be on the ballot in 2014, and if it did go down, then you'd have to wait a good amount of time to put it back up on the ballot. And that's the fear. Some of the people who are backing the issue say, hey, you know, we really have reservations about putting it on in 2014. If you think about that kind of election, who does it draw? It doesn't typically draw young people who are definitely, from every study we've seen, they're more inclined to vote for same-sex marriage than any other age group. That's also the age group that doesn't come out so much to vote for governor, but they'll come out for president. So, I mean, you know, there's that concern of getting the people to the polls that would vote for it.
On the other hand, it could get a lot of people to the polls who don't ordinarily come out at
exactly.
that time, and it could help the Democratic ticket because they also tend to be more liberal.
Yes, if you got them out there and you got them energized, but the question is, how much money are you going to put into it to get that mm-hmm. population out there? How much are you going to do?
And the advocacy groups for same-sex marriage, they're splintered still.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They're not together on this.
No, you've got one group that's out circulating petitions that wants to put it on the ballot next year. You have another group that says it's not time, we need to work on it. And they're focused on an education campaign to help people understand the issue more. So you do have a disagreement by people who are proponents of gay marriage.
Mm-hmm. And you got to remember that while that might bring some young people out to vote for it, there are a lot of people who are against the idea who don't typically vote either, and they would come out of the
right.
woodwork to vote against it. I mean, this
right.
is one of those hot-button issues that's very emotional, and it could have, you know, with a state that we have looking at the polling— we have a majority now that supports same-sex marriage, according to the polls.
Yeah.
But depending on who turns out, that could really impact the vote.
Well, and the timing of it in 14, as a journalist, the timeliness seems to be there to me because you've got, you know, Obama has made his big statement on the issue. We've got Rob Portman, who's made his big statement on the issue.
Jim Petro.
Right. And so a lot of politicians are sort of putting their necks out to bring some momentum to this. So I don't know whether those who won it in 16 probably have a candidate for president that they care about boosting, like mm-hmm. you say, as opposed to boosting a Democratic ticket that probably has a less than likely chance of beating John Kasich.
We have just about a minute left. So, you know, Mark Kovac, why don't you just take it away with the election law? What's going on there?
Oh, you have the legislature just passed a bill to require more verification of people's eligibility using databases and potentially reduce the number of voting machines counties are required to have. There's still a handful of Republican bills out there that would eliminate Golden Week, that time when you can register to vote and cast a ballot on the same day. Mm-hmm. There's a legislation dealing with absentee ballots. There's other reform moves, maybe online voter registration. I would think that if they're going to move those bills, they're going to have to do it in January to give enough time to implement it before the primary in the spring.
All right. Well, I hope you guys have a happy new year, happy holiday, and happy new year.
Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you. Christmas.
Mark Kovac, State House reporter for the Youngstown Vindicator, Joe Engels of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. From our Reporters Roundtable, we wish you a very happy holiday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is listener-supported WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus. We're online at WOSU.org.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, the new Christmas album from the jazz vocal group New York Voices.
When I see you smile at me, I hear a haunting melody, and I surrender to the tender thrill it brings. A holiday for strings, sweet music all around me.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
As the song begins, I hear a host of
this afternoon, along with all the day's news from 2 till 4. Support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, whose wellness series continues for 2014. The second annual Ross Heart Hospital 5K walk and run takes place February 8th at Easton Town Center. Details on this 5K and the entire wellness series are at rosswellnessseries.org. 22 degrees with a little light snow, a high of 27 today. It's 11 o'clock.
It's the little things in life. You've heard that before, but since when are relationships with our family, friends, work, and community a little thing? Since when is being passionate about something little? Maybe all the little things in life that distract us every day and more as we immerse ourselves in 24/7 technology are the problem. Coming up, we'll talk about recalling our personal missions and finding a way to respond to the calling. And we'll hear stories about how some people find their mission in helping others, a theme that always resonates during this season of giving. That's coming up after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/AllSides.